My idea and product is a new kind of product category. It provides these key problems and these solutions and these features, unlike competing products such as Acme and Johnson Company and Smith Company. My idea and my products have these important features. So that's the structure. Here's an example of a quick introduction for a big idea I'll call Energy Tech 1000. For companies with large buildings in California and Arizona who are dissatisfied with their aging solar panels, my product is a plug-and-play solar accelerator. It provides 35% more energy from old panels, and unlike the cost of replacing panels, my product is inexpensive and has no moving parts. Right, so that's it. The big idea can be introduced with this pattern in about 1 minute. Here's another example of the idea introduction pattern. For busy executives who don't have enough workspace on their computer monitor, my product is a visual array that provides 8 flat screen monitors linked together that can fit on any desk. Unlike the common do-it-yourself solutions having just 2 or 3 monitors, my visual array lets executives use Excel, Firefox, Word, Gmail, Skype, Photoshop, Explorer, and Trading Desk all at the same time with no confusing windows. So continuing the examples, here's how Joe used the idea introduction pattern to introduce his airport deal. This is example 3. For investors needing a 10% cash yield or better, who are dissatisfied with risky investments such as stocks, my airport deal is a project with low risk and lots of protection that provides a current cash flow. And unlike most development projects, you can cash out anytime you want. So certainly this does a lot to capture the target's attention. It is important to realize, however, that capturing the target's attention doesn't mean that you're commanding attention. You will soon be skeptical that attention can ever be commanded. What's worse, you'll appreciate how it can be lost in a few seconds by making a few wrong moves. The rudimentary model of how attention works goes like this. We notice things that have movement through space and time because they are most likely to be important. But there's a catch. A lot of time, the things that move are also things that we have to run away from. Starting from this premise in the pitch, we want to create attention without threat. This is why I've come to believe in and rely on the idea introduction pattern. Because of all the ways to introduce an idea, it does the least to trigger threat avoidance in the croc brain. Neuroscientist Evian Gordon is convinced that minimizing danger and threats around us is the fundamental organizing principle of the brain. As I've said before, the croc brain doesn't think about threats too deeply. It just reacts. It doesn't stop to research whether the snake coming toward us is a copperhead or a cottonmouth. Although this natural defense mechanism is beneficial in evolutionary terms, researchers believe that when we enter a social situation, like a boardroom where we're expected to pitch, there's one undeniable fact. We sense a potential threat to our own well-being. For example, we could get rejected. We could embarrass ourselves. We could lose the deal or lose face. When these social threats appear, the threat avoidance system in our own brain starts pumping adrenaline and other neurotransmitters. Anxiety kicks in. We've all felt it. That moment, we're standing in front of an audience and it feels like they're not paying attention. Our heart rate increases, our face turns flush, and sweat pores open up. We're responding to a social threat. It's important to recognize that humans are hardwired for social interaction. So if you haven't thought of social situations as potential threats, it might be time to start thinking that way right now. In one study, researchers had subjects play a computer game where they thought they were throwing a digital ball with a few other participants. After a while of playing the game, the subject's online partners started throwing the ball only to each other, leaving the subject as the odd man out. Ouch, right? The researchers measured the subject's reaction through brain scans. What they found is that social threats engage the same threat response system in the brain as physical threats do. And to make matters worse, the brain can trigger threat responses far ahead of when you consciously become aware of the threat. If you don't use the idea introduction pattern to deliver the big idea or some other highly controlled way to encapsulate the big idea, here's how trouble can start brewing. First, the target picks up on your anxiety. Second, when you see the target get uncomfortable, you get more tense and you look tense. Third, an endless feedback loop starts. The target senses your anxiety, and a similar threat response triggers in his system. You have lots more to do in this pitch. You've barely started, and you don't want to get caught up in this negative feedback loop. It's too early in the pitch to start dealing with serious malfunctions. The idea introduction pattern breaks the idea down to the essential basics. Here's what it is, here's who it's for, and here's who I compete with. No anxiety, no fear, no drama. Let's review the actions to take in phase one of the pitch. First, you put the target at ease by telling him in advance that the pitch is going to be short, just about 20 minutes, and that you're not going to be hanging around too long afterwards. This keeps the target's croc brain focused on the here and now and feeling safe. Then you give your background in terms of a track record of successes, not a long list of places and institutions where you simply punch the clock. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that the more you talk about your background, the more average it becomes, because the target is hardwired to average information about you, not add it up. Next, you show that your idea is not a static flash of genius. Rather, there are market forces driving the idea, and you are taking advantage of a brief market window that has opened up. And you've admitted that there will be competition, showing that you're not naive about the realities of business. Because the brain pays attention to things that are in motion, you paint a picture of the idea moving out of the old market into the new one. Doing it this way, you don't trigger change blindness, which would make your deal easy to neglect. Last, you bring the big idea into play using the idea introduction pattern. Now the target knows exactly what it is, who it's for, who you compete with, and what your idea does better than the competition's. This simple pattern makes sure your idea is easy to grasp, and it focuses on what is real. This strategy works so well because it avoids triggering a threat response. However, this method should not imply that everything in your pitch must be simplified and reduced. You'll be delivering plenty of complex and detail-oriented information soon. Phase two of the pitch: explain the budget and the secret sauce. It's been easy to maintain the target's attention so far. In phase one, all you had to do was introduce yourself and the big idea in about 5 minutes or less. In phase two, it gets harder to hold the target's attention. Now you have to explain what problems the big idea really solves and how it actually works. The opportunities to scare the croc brain seriously multiply when you start to explain how stuff works. Over the years, an enormous amount of pressure has been put on business people to make complex ideas more simple. But few gurus have come up with the methods to do this that translate into real-world success. At least I haven't seen them, and I've been looking for 10 years or more. The frustrating thing about simplicity is that it's supposed to work wonders in a presentation. Summarize your information. Make it super easy to understand. Roll the concepts into an executive summary, and the target will love you for it. I realize that what comes next goes against conventional wisdom, but what I've discovered is that simplicity really doesn't matter. If it really worked, simplifying everything, everyone would be doing it, but it doesn't and they aren't. Simplicity can make you seem naive or unsophisticated. You can underwhelm the target with too little information just as easily as you can overwhelm him with too much information. What you really want to do is tune the message to the mind of the target. Think about the way you have to talk to a child. You don't just make the thing you want to say simple. For example, if you want to say there's no dessert being served before dinner is eaten, you don't make it more simple and say no dessert before dinner. In fact, you might have to make it even longer and more complex, explaining the reasons. Again, what's important is that child's mind is different from your own, and you have to understand how that mind reasons. This is why it's so important to understand how the croc brain reasons. I've concluded that ideas you come up with for your problem-solving brain, the neocortex, must be intentionally retuned for the croc brain that will receive them. Early in my work to figure this stuff out, I stumbled onto something cognitive psychologists call the theory of mind, and that supports the ideas I'm talking about. When you have a working theory of mind, you are able to understand how thoughts, desires, and intentions of others cause them to act. When someone can only see a situation one way, their theory of mind is weak or inoperative. When you have a strong theory of mind, you recognize how other people have different perspectives, and that they know different things about the situation and that their desires are not always the same as your desires. A strong theory of mind also will let you know that anything involving statistics needs to be highly simplified. The croc brain hates thinking about probabilities. Our advanced society had to invent complex formulas and equations for statistics exactly because our brains are not wired to think about statistics on their own. While there's ongoing debate about what complexity the average audience will like and dislike, one thing is certain. If you're describing relationships between people, you can provide plenty of detail. The brain is really good at understanding complex human relationships. As I look back on my experiences, two giant realizations tower above all others. Realization one, it doesn't matter how much information you give, a lot or a little, but instead how good your theory of mind is. In other words, it's important how well you can tune your information to the other person's mind. Realization two, all the important stuff must fit into an audience's limits of attention, which for most people is about 20 minutes. So let's talk about how to get their attention. Earlier, I said that one of the things that can go wrong is that your pitch is boring. In a large majority of presentations, this is the problem. In fact, virtually everyone is long-winded when they present. Yet there's absolutely no doubt among either executives or academics that audience attention fades out fast once a presentation has started. Studies of vigilance show that the targets generally can't focus on an idea for more than a few minutes. Some believe that it's only a few seconds. Either way, why quibble? Attention wavers almost uncontrollably. People's minds wander. Distractions from inside the person and the outside world are constantly competing with your ideas, your pitch. And anyway, even if there were no distractions, the brain is still a cognitive miser. It wants to exert as little energy as possible figuring out you and your idea. What grabs the target's attention? And once attention is grabbed, what holds it there? Attention will be given when information novelty is high, and it will drift away when information novelty is low. You already know this, right? If your stuff looks boring, if it has no visual stimulus, if it is a bunch of cold hard facts and it involves spaghetti-like complexity, no one is going to offer you much attention. Yet there's nothing more important than attention. Oh, we can vigorously debate whether attention accounts for 70% of the reason someone succeeds with a pitch or 50%, but no one can seriously question that getting and holding attention are the biggest reasons a pitch either connects with the target and succeeds or misses the target and fails. Look at it another way. If the target were willing to pay attention to you for a few hours, then just about any pitch, good or bad, would work. But you don't have hours. More likely, you've got those 20 minutes we've been talking about. And maybe if you're just winging it, you only have 5 minutes before your pitch wanders into a mental no man's land. So what is attention? To control attention, I've always felt it's important to know what it's made of. Attention is sort of a vague, all-encompassing term that just seems to define itself. But who would ever try to make a martini without knowing what's in it first? I phrase the question this way because you'll see in a moment the attention is just that, a cocktail of chemicals served up to the brain as a lubricant for social interaction. You need to know how to blend this perfect cocktail and when to serve it. How did I find out what the ingredients are? I didn't have to. Researchers with brain scanners and hardcore neuroscience chops did the work for me. What they've worked out is that when a person is feeling both desire and tension, that person is paying serious attention to what's in front of him or her. The critical lesson of brain scans is that attention is always a delicate and unstable balancing act between desire and tension. It comes down to the presence of two neurotransmitters, dopamine and norepinephrine. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter of desire. Norepinephrine is the neurotransmitter of tension. Together, they add up to attention. If you want someone's undivided, fully engaged attention, you have to provide these two neurotransmitters. These two chemicals work together, and you need them both to be coursing through the crocodile brain of the target, but each has a different triggering mechanism. To give a dopamine kick and create desire, you have to offer a reward. To give a norepinephrine kick and create tension, you have to take something away. You're going to learn the patterns for triggering the desire and the tension responses right now. So what does dopamine do? Dopamine is the chemical in the brain that chases rewards. It takes about 1/20th of a second for dopamine to guide humans towards some kind of action. Dopamine levels rise in the brain when you see or hear something you want. When you see a person acting curious, open-minded, and interested in something, it's dopamine that's motivating them. A strong cup of coffee, yohimbe root cocaine, and the cold medicine Sudafed all increase dopamine levels in the brain. In most people, so does the thought of winning a large gamble or of even buying something which is known as an ornament, like a Rolex watch or some other status-enhancing product. Dopamine release in the brain is connected to pleasure activities, such things as food, sex, and drugs. But now, brain scans show that dopamine isn't exactly the chemical of experiencing pleasure. Instead, it's the chemical of anticipating a reward. In his book, Satisfaction, Dr. Greg Burns explains it like this. How do you get more dopamine flowing in your brain? Novelty. A raft of brain imaging experiments has demonstrated that novel events are highly effective at releasing dopamine. Your brain is stimulated by surprise because our world is fundamentally unpredictable. He adds, you may not always like novelty, but your brain does. You create novelty by violating the target's expectations in a pleasing way. Let's review. When you introduce something novel to the target's brain, a release of dopamine occurs. This triggers desire. For example, a short product demo provides novelty. A new idea provides novelty. Good metaphors for otherwise complex subjects provide novelty. Bright objects, moving objects, and unique shapes, sizes, and configurations, they all provide novelty. You want the audience's full attention, and you want to erase everything else that audience members are paying attention to, so then introduce novelty. Let's talk about how dopamine leads the feeling of novelty. Until now, we've talked about the raw amount of information that comes into the brain and how it all can't be processed at once. All this information and data from the senses collect in one small part of the brain. There has to be some way of selecting what to ignore and what to act on. Dopamine motivates the human body to act on some things and to ignore others. Research done at the University College London, written about in the Wall Street Journal by reporter Jason Zweig, suggests that getting what you expected to get produces no dopamine kick. But a novelty in the form of unexpected gain gives the brain a blast of dopamine. On the other hand, if a reward you expected fails to materialize, then all the dopamine dries up and negative feelings start happening. Just like the martini making we talked about earlier, the amount of dopamine in the cocktail has to be just right. Not enough, and there's no interest in your ideas or you. Too much, and there is fear or anxiety. Earlier, we also talked about the importance of a simple introduction to your big idea, but that simple is not always better. The dopamine kick explains why. People enjoy some intermediate level of intellectual complexity. It has been argued that people are curious about things they cannot explain, but that seem explainable. Mystery stories work this way, and this, of course, is why novelty is so important in the pitch. Curiosity is the croc brain becoming interested, feeling like it's safe to learn more. Curiosity derives from an information gap, the difference between what you know and what you want to know. This is the addictive quality of curiosity and what you're trying to create for the target, curiosity about your big idea. It's only when the target feels that he knows enough to fully understand your big idea that the curiosity ends and he becomes satiated. At that point of satiation, whether you recognize it or not, the pitch is over. Novel information has the potential to trigger one of two responses, retreat or exploration. Curiosity is a feeling of novel information taking on the second exploratory path, which is the first step towards a satisfying intellectual experience. When a signal from the pitch tells the target there is something new to be discovered, dopamine is released in the brain. Unexpected and pleasant rewards release more dopamine than expected ones. But dopamine has a dark side, too. If the target is expecting a reward and doesn't get it, dopamine levels fall off fast. When dopamine levels drop that fast, the feeling of stress is triggered and is just around the corner. Not only does a target stop taking in new information from you, but he starts forgetting the information you've already delivered. In summary, expecting rewards generates dopamine. Dopamine is the buzz of novelty. Alone, however, it's not enough to create attention. While dopamine is the chemical of curiosity, interest, and desire, it can't generate attention without norepinephrine, which tends to create tension. This is why I call it the chemical of alertness. Let's talk about tension. In the earlier discussion of novelty and desire, I talked about just half the formula for creating attention. The other half of that formula is tension, right? First, let's start with some definitions. Tension is the introduction of some real consequences to the social encounter. It's the response to a clear and unequivocal realization that something will be gained or lost. It is letting the target know that there are high stakes in this meeting. Tension indicates consequences and therefore importance. There's no reason for the target to pay attention when there are no stakes. When tension is absent, it makes no sense to pay attention. A few words about the purpose of tension will help. Here, we're interested in the interplay between pushing the target away and pulling him towards us. Not as a point of manipulation. At no point in the pitch are we ever interested in that, but as a way to keep the target alert. If you want your target focused and energized, to really pay full attention, you must get him to stay alert. Tension accomplishes this by injecting a shot of norepinephrine into the target's brain. This brings us to an examination of the relationship between novelty and tension. Without both of these, Dennis, the avocado farmer, loses $640,000. We talked about that before. Jaws becomes one of the worst movies of all time, and Benoit, the French waiter, can barely make a living. We may never have thought about attention this way before, as a cocktail of neurotransmitters, and honestly, why bother now? We certainly don't know what neurotransmitters are, and if we're being honest with ourselves, this is something we really don't care about at a deep level. Biology, neurotransmitter, neuroscience. To most of us, it's worthwhile only in that it illustrates the following. The two parts of the attention cocktail are novelty and tension, which in a pitch work together in a feedback loop for about 20 minutes until no matter what you do or how hard you try, they get out of balance and then stop working altogether. Tension comes from conflict. Some beginner presenters want to rely on their charisma, right? That's a pure form of novelty, and try to avoid all conflict in their pitch narrative. They want everyone to play nice, only smiles, no grimaces. Why? Because in regular life outside the pitch, confrontation can be stressful and nerve-wracking. So it makes sense that we would try to avoid it everywhere. But in narrative and frame-based pitching, you cannot be afraid of tension. In fact, you have to create it. The rudimentary patterns I've outlined below have proved extremely rewarding in my career. This might seem surprising, not because the patterns are so simple and basic, but because they are intended to build tension. This is what has given me an edge. There are three tension patterns, each with an increasing level of intensity. These are conversational patterns that you can use at any point in a presentation when you sense the target's attention is dropping. So here's the low-key, low-intensity push-pull pattern. Push. Guys, there's a real possibility that we might not be right for each other. Then pause, allow that to sink in, and it has to be authentic. And then here's the pull. But then again, if this did work out, our forces could combine to become something great. Now here's the medium intensity push-pull pattern. And this is the push part. There's so much more to a deal than just the idea. I mean, there's a venture capital group in San Francisco that doesn't even care about what the idea is. They don't even look at it when the deal comes in. The only thing they care about is who the people are behind the deal. That makes sense. I've learned that ideas are common, a dime a dozen. What really counts is having someone in charge who has passion and experience and integrity. So if you and I don't have that view in common, passion, experience, integrity, it would never work out between us. Now a pause, and then the pull. But that's crazy to think. Obviously, you value people over smart ideas. I've met corporate robots before, and they only care about numbers, and you are definitely not a robot. You're a people person, and I think we have some very important things in common, our value system. So here's a high-intensity push-pull pattern, and here's the push. Based on the couple of reactions I'm getting from you, it seems like this isn't a good fit. I think that you should only do deals where there is trust and deals that you strongly believe in. So let's just wrap this up for now and agree to get together on the next one. Pause, wait for a response, start packing up your stuff, and be willing to leave if the target doesn't stop you. That's the high-intensity push-pull pattern. There's a two-way connection between pushing and pulling that, when it operates simultaneously, introduces enough tension to create alertness. If you always pull the target towards you, he or she becomes cautious and anxious. Constantly pulling someone in, also known as selling hard, is a signal of neediness. It's a balancing act, of course, right? Because if you're constantly pushing them away, they will take the hint and just leave. One of the most celebrated examples of this push-pull in the pitch community involves Mad Men's Don Draper, a pitchman for a fictional ad agency who gets a negative reaction from a client during a pitch. This is how he pushes. "Looks like there's not much else to do here. Let's call it a day," he tells a client, extending a handshake. "Gentlemen, thank you for your time." Draper then just stands up to leave. I've watched the clip on many occasions, and the result always leaves me with a greater appreciation for the perfect push-pull delivery, one that creates a blast of norepinephrine in the client's brain. In the clip, the tension grows as the client, surprised, asks, "Is that all?" Draper replies, "Hey, you're a non-believer. Why should we waste time on kabuki theater?" The client responds to the push, suddenly interested in Draper's ideas and in paying attention. He asks Draper to please sit back down. You should watch the clip. Perhaps the most outstanding example of a push-pull pattern that I've encountered occurred some years ago when an audience tried to impose its will on me at a conference. I was offered an opportunity to pitch my deals to a handful of the most influential investors in a $10 billion market. How could I resist? I would meet them at an upcoming conference in a closed room, one-on-one experience. The conference organizers charged me $18,000 for the privilege, and then they set it all up. I gladly paid the fee, and I jumped on my company jet to Denver, looking forward to a great opportunity to generate a lot of new business. After breakfast, I went up to the conference room ready to rock and roll. I walked in, but I was shocked by what I saw. Inside the room were 25 people, many more than I expected. And here's the kicker. They were not investors or buyers, the deal makers. They were due diligence analysts. I shook my head. I couldn't believe it. I just paid $18,000 to be in a room with a bunch of analysts. A due diligence analyst, as the name suggests, is someone whose job it is to analyze and evaluate a deal based on facts and figures. These are neocortex people, and they are tough to pitch to because they're all about numbers and they're trained to avoid emotion. Imagine a bunch of nicely dressed robots looking for flaws in everything you do and say. Dealing with just one of these people is hard enough, but now I stood in front of 25 of them, and none of them could pull the trigger on the deal anyway. This was the worst possible audience for my deal. The tables and chairs were set up in a U-shape, and I stepped up to the horseshoe despite my misgivings about continuing. I started my pitch by passing out our marketing materials, a beautiful 56-page deal book. The book outlined the math behind a new kind of financial technique called bifurcation, which can really amplify profits. As the audience studied it page by page, I launched into my pitch, and I absolutely nailed it. Or at least that's what I thought. But my pitch was all dopamine and no epinephrine. That is to say, all promise of reward, but no tension. I looked up at one point, hoping to see smiling faces, expecting to hear a barrage of questions from these due diligence guys. Instead, I got stone-cold faces looking back at me. Silence. Not a single question. Imagine looking out at 25 concrete garden gnomes. I can't remember such a non-response to one of my pitches ever. This doesn't mean that the targets were unreachable. It just means they had strong analyst frames that were not easily disrupted. I said, "Guys, since you can't think of any questions to throw at me, let me get those marketing books back from you." I started walking around the horseshoe, taking them gently out of their hands. In some cases, I had to pull more aggressively. That's when I knew I had the prize frame. Now they had something to lose, and questions started flowing. Over the next 2 years, I closed $5 million with those targets, just from creating a little bit of extra tension. To hold your target's attention, there must be tension, a form of low-level conflict guiding the interaction. If there's no conflict, The target may be politely listening, but there's no real connection. The target is thinking, huh, he seems like a nice guy and his idea seems good, but I have other things to worry about right now. This is a confidence problem. I used to be afraid of creating tension. I was afraid to do anything that might upset the target in any way. Sure, when you and the target are each nodding in happy agreement, it feels great in the moment. You think to yourself, it's a love fest. But when it goes on too long with no counterbalance, it's boring. At the end, the target gets up and says, that was really nice. And then he walks away. Targets want a challenge of some sort. They don't want easy answers from you. If there's a single reason why some of my most important pitches failed, it's because I was nice and the audience was nice and we're all very polite with each other. There was no tension or conflict. Conflict is the basis of interesting human connections. As business people, we come together to find solutions to problems, not to admire problems that have already been solved for us. If you don't have a series of challenges for the target to overcome with pushes and pulls and tension loops, then you don't have a pitch narrative. A pitch narrative can be thought of as a series of tension loops, push, then pull, create tension, then resolve it. When there's no tension between you and the target, there's no interest in what happens, there's no stakes. The target also has no emotional involvement in what's going on. In other words, the target doesn't much care what you do, why you're doing it, or what happens to you after you leave. Without tension loops, nothing is compelling the reader to stay with the pitch storyline. Let's talk about the heart of the pitch. Once you have attention by creating desire and tension, you're ready to deliver the heart of your pitch. But keep moving fast because this cocktail of dopamine and norepinephrine you're serving up is sloshing around in the brain of the target in the right combination, but just for a few minutes. As we discussed earlier, no matter how hard you work, eventually the target's desire is going to become fear and the tension in the room is going to turn into anxiety. The greatest problem in short-form pitching is deciding what details and specifics to single out for attention and what to leave out. And since I'll need to give you specific examples, I think that selling a company or raising money is a good framework in which to discuss this subject. For one thing, it's the market with which I'm most familiar. I've been working in the capital markets for about 15 years. For another, these markets have provided a fantastic testbed for me because hard data and fast feedback has been readily available. I've got this down to a method and a science. Actually, delivering the core of the pitch is very straightforward stuff. The main requirement is that you understand what's happening in your mind is not what's happening in the target's mind. Package the information for the croc brain, as I described in chapter one. Big picture, high contrast, visual, novel, with verified evidence. Before you decide to spend too much time on this part of the presentation, remember that the following items are a simple punch list of issues that most pitches have to cover. These are prerequisites, the stuff you have to have no matter what. It's the minimum information you need to be able to show up and be relevant. Recognize that you can be incredible at turning a business plan into an executive summary or any other kind of elevator pitch and still have the pitch fail miserably. Doing a good job here is not about some genius way of organizing and presenting information, right? Would you argue with this? We don't need yet another organizing theory for information. The basics work fine. What we need is a way to present our material without the target becoming too analytical about it. When it comes to a choice of what to focus on when pitching and what will make your big idea work, I would start by presenting the budget because most people screw this up. It's your chance to be different. So let's talk about pitching numbers and projections. In his book, High Tech Ventures, Gordon Bell writes, startups often prepare absurdly aggressive and optimistic plans, which have a very low likelihood of success, just to maximize the company's perceived dollar value. Your financial projections, whether for a product or a company or an idea, are supposed to answer such basic questions as, how strong is the company? What if the plans go wrong? Does the company have enough cash to last a few bad quarters? Do you know how to budget well? A word of caution, however, as you approach these topics, every experienced buyer and investor knows that you will be doing the following two things. One, saying that your budgets are conservative, and two, preparing absurdly aggressive and optimistic plans. To an investor, for example, every financial plan looks the same. A hockey stick chart up and to the right that shows the following. We need lots of money today, and way down the road, we'll make it back. Right? And sometimes it works out this way, but usually it doesn't. Unrealistic budgets and miscalculating costs are the greatest risks to a growing company, especially startups. How do you get around the skepticism that will surely fall on your plans? Focus on demonstrating your skill on budgeting, which is a difficult and highly regarded executive talent. Spend almost no time on your skills at projecting revenue, a task that any simpleton can perform. Let's talk about competition. The act of introducing the budgets to the targets will lead him or her to wonder, who does the big idea compete with? This is a valid question that you cannot ignore. The attractiveness of an idea is based on the industry it's in and how much competition there is for it. Yet almost no one describes the competition they face in adequate ways. Let's do it right in our pitch. Here are two major elements of competition. Number one, how easy is it for new competitors to jump in the game? Number two, how easy is it for customers to switch out of your product into someone else's? That's how you address competition. Let's talk about secret sauce. To avoid the impression that you're a come-and-go idea that will shine brightly in the market one day and be forgotten soon after, you'll need to show what your competitive advantage is based on. This one thing will give you staying power against competition. In almost every pitch situation, you need something special. Briefly describe it as your secret sauce, the unfair advantage you have over others. You don't have to get too fancy here. Just don't take longer than 10 minutes to describe the fundamental workings of your big idea, because you're going to need the last 5 minutes to offer the deal and to stack frames. Think the need to move fast doesn't apply to you? You want to leisurely take an hour to do all this? I've met many people who don't believe in the limits of human attention, and they feel exempt from the consequences of running long. An investment banker I know brags, "I can read them the phone book for an hour, and they'll pay attention." Is the science wrong? Should we forget about dopamine and epinephrine cocktails entirely? Look, consider for a minute the actor Jerry Seinfeld. His movie, Comedian, is a behind-the-scenes look at the business of performing comedy. In it, Seinfeld reveals the difficulty of being in front of an audience. He is one of the most recognized personalities anywhere in the world, probably the best-known comedian on the planet. Sure, there's Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle and Robin Williams, but really, when you think about it, Jerry Seinfeld is as big as it gets. When he decides to go on the road and to test new material, Jerry says it's not as easy as you might think. He can walk on the stage anywhere, even a small town, and it's clear that the audience knows he's one of the most accomplished performers of modern times, with over $1 billion of television revenues to his credit. So they're thrilled to be in the presence of a man so popular and so funny. But the thrill doesn't last long. "I have about 3 minutes where they will just listen to whatever I have to say," Seinfeld says. "But after that, it can fall apart fast. I get no credit. After 3 minutes, I just have to be as funny as any other comedian. That's it. All they give me is 3 minutes." And there's more to the story. Seinfeld became aware of the 3-minute mark because it takes him as long as a month of full-time work to build up just 3 minutes of quality comedy content. When he first goes out on tour, that's about all the material he starts with, 3 minutes. It takes him months more steady work to build up 20 minutes of comedy material that can hold an audience's attention. That's worth thinking about. One of the most well-known performers and presenters in the world has to put months of hard work to build up to 20 minutes of material. And when he eventually goes on stage, the average audience will cut him slack for what? 3 minutes. After that, the material has to be really good or the audience will turn on him. So when we frame the issue of how long a pitch should be, with the Jerry Seinfeld story in mind, it becomes easier to understand why time is so precious in the pitch. How long can you really be interesting to listen to? Perhaps there is someone who can pitch a deal as dull as a phone book for an hour, which is up to 3 times the basic limits of human attention. But if so, he or she is a lot smarter and more charismatic than Seinfeld or any other entertainer or pitchman or businessman that I know. Phase 3 of the pitch is offering the deal. In the third phase of the pitch process, you need to do one thing and do it well. Describe to your audience what they're going to receive when they decide to do business with you. You want to push through this quickly for the sake of time and then get back to framing. in clear and concise terms, tell the audience exactly what you will be delivering to them, when it will be delivered, and how. If they play a part in the process, explain what their roles and responsibilities will be. Don't drill down into a lot of detail. Just provide summarized facts that they need to know so that their mental picture of your offering is complete. It does not matter if you are offering a product, a service, an investment, or an intangible. There will be a fulfillment process involved, and that is what you must explain. Keep it brief, but rich in high-level details so there is no question as to what the audience is going to get. And remember, the most important deliverable in your deal is you. Chapter 5, Frame Stacking and Hot Cognitions. In Chapter 4, I showed you the first three phases of a pitch. By this point, you've held the target's attention for a while. The target knows the essentials, who you are, why this idea is important, how it works, what the secret sauce is, and what the target gets when he buys. But you're here to do more than just show and tell. This is a pitch, and you're here to make a deal happen. Now you have about 5 minutes left to propose something concrete and actionable, something so compelling that it will cause your target to chase you to get what you have. Welcome to the next phase. Phase 4 is frame stacking and hot cognitions. In the course of my activities seeking out money for deals, I discovered that investors do not operate only on cold, rational calculation. Do you think that the guy sitting across the table from you is an analytical machine? Think about this. The target can like your deal or be afraid of it before he knows much detail about it. And the target probably can decide yes or no without even knowing what it is. This is hot cognition at work. Deciding that you like something before you fully understand it, that's a hot cognition. We've been led to believe over time by managers, consultants, bankers, professors of finance, that business is analytical, that it's rational, that there are three very well-ordered stages to each business decision. Identify the problem, examine the solutions, and make judgments. This makes sense, and this is how it should be in a perfect economic world. In fact, if you took out a blank sheet of paper and asked yourself, how should I make a decision? That's how you probably would do it. Research, analyze, decide. And if we were all computer-like or even behave like rational economists think we do, it would work this way. But we aren't, and it doesn't. What's intriguing here is that when we decide on something, we believe that it's because we thought it through or we used a decision matrix. We think that we are smart, careful, and rational decision makers. In decision making, however, we don't do much analysis, if any at all. We go with our gut. When Jack Welch eventually wrote his biography, it wasn't called Intense Analysis. It was titled Straight from the Gut. And when George Soros updates his next edition of The Alchemy of Finance, he's going to include the research of Dr. Flavia Simbalista, who believes that we feel decisions in our body, not in our mind. There's a whole side to us that computers don't have, and the rational economic man economists like to talk about doesn't have either. Our bodies know the situations we meet in life and how we should respond. Brain scanners can see your decisions before you make them. That's the title of a provocative article that appeared in Wired magazine. The first line in the article reads, "You may think you decided to read this story, but in fact, your brain made the decision long before you knew about it." Referring to a study by John Haynes, a Max Planck Institute neuroscientist. Haynes says, "Your decisions are strongly prepared by brain activity. By the time consciousness kicks in, most of the work has already been done." The patterns he found in the brain consistently predicted whether test subjects eventually pushed a button with their left or right hand about 7 seconds before they felt they made a conscious decision to do it. Do you still think your decisions are post-conscious? In other words, that you rationally think about things and make decisions afterwards? The peer group is shrinking of people who actually think like that. We tend to like or dislike things before we know much about them. People do not become friends with each other, choose one career over another, or choose which sport to watch on the weekend based on a detailed cognitive analysis of the pros and cons of each situation. If we stop to think about it, most major decisions are not made by a cold cognitive process, such as an evaluation and analysis, but instead by a hot cognition. We quickly realize that there are probably very few decisions in our lives that aren't hot. Most of the time, the data we have collected about choices and alternatives and opinions and options aren't used to make a decision anyway. They're used to justify decisions after the fact. We buy the cars we like, we choose the jobs and houses we find attractive, and then justify those choices to other people with any number of facts and explanations. Why this deal? Why this investment? We don't need facts and explanations to convince ourselves. We know what we like. Even when we try the rational approach, making a list of pros and cons, if it does not come out how we like, we go back and redo the list until it does. If you had invested $1,000 with George Soros when he opened his quantum fund, you would have about $4 million today in that account. Yet he is known for whimsically changing his investment tactics. We're talking market positions of hundreds of millions of dollars on a feeling in his back or some other physical signal in his body. Simbalista, who has studied Soros and financial decision-making, writes, "This might sound mysterious, but in fact, human thinking is constantly guided by subtle body tensions. Traders need to learn how to isolate and identify those bodily tensions and relate them to the analysis of the market and the problem at hand." Certainly, Soros, who has learned how to combine theory and instinct to make money, does this. George Soros's backache decision-making is consistent with the research of Dr. Jerome Bruner. According to Bruner, there are two modes of cognitive functioning, two modes of thought, each providing distinctive ways of ordering experience and constructing reality. Bruner says that one mode of constructing reality is called the paradigmatic mode. One can think of this as detective mode. In the paradigmatic mode, the target takes the content of your pitch and analyzes it in terms of tightly reasoned analysis, logical proof, and empirical observation. In other words, the information you're providing is getting analyzed. If you push your listener into this mode, he or she is looking to find a formula that explains you. Your audience or target will be doing only one thing in paradigmatic mode, trying to analyze. So all of your creative concepts, future projections, and human inferences are going to be ignored by the analytical paradigmatic thinker. The only thing that will count are cold, hard facts. In our pitch, we're not looking to engage with the cold neocortex. We are not going to push people into paradigmatic mode. And we don't need a quantitative analysis of our numbers done by the target right now or really at any point. Sure, our numbers will stand up to scrutiny and we're not afraid of a stress test, but there will be a time for cold analysis later once the relationship is firmly set in place. So let's discuss creating hot cognition. To avoid cold, reasoned analysis, unemotional judgment of ourselves and our idea, we're going to create hot cognition by stacking frames. I came to learn about stacking frames by accident. How to stack frames. Part of my work involves buying defaulted debt with a partner. Specifically, that's high-risk debt. It's a hard-knocks game where it seems that you either do very well or you get crushed. My partner did about $250 million of transactions from 2008 to 2010. In this field, however, $250 million is small time among the multi-billion dollar hedge funds and the giants of Wall Street, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. So our success is based on keeping alert, making quick small trades of $20 million to $50 million. We are like gazelles running among elephants. In this game, if you sense a giant foot coming down, you take off running fast, because if JP Morgan, Chase Manhattan, or Goldman Sachs steps on you, they wouldn't even notice, but you would. In June of 2008, the market was in the early stages of a screaming free fall that bottomed out in March of 2009. And we knew it was bad, but we didn't know how bad it was going to get. At one point, the housing market in Phoenix dropped 9% in a single month. Movements of the Dow Jones Industrial Index of 100 points a day was the norm. Any Wall Street trader knows that you want to be careful trading in this kind of volatility because a single mistake can cause you to blow up. Buying distressed assets sounds like it should be easy, right? After all, the market was crumbling and everybody needed to sell their toxic assets. At the time, I was doing a deal with a trading desk at one of the largest money center banks. I need another point of view on this deal, so I called a colleague of mine, Mike. He had a lot of experience in this kind of deal, and a second opinion is always good, right? I thought that the price was high and I wasn't too sure about the deal. Now, as I stayed late at work on a Wednesday night, the phone rang. It was a trader at this large money center Wall Street bank, and this was his fifth call to me. In the back of my croc brain, threat alerts started going off. Why was this $300 billion bank courting me so hard? There had to be better buyers in the market, right? But once I started talking to the trader, I realized that he wasn't selling me in traditional ways. Oren, once we get through this deal and we know you can close deals, I'm going to introduce you to our senior trader, John Kincaid, the seller told me. He's a wild man just like you. It's going to be a total love connection, and he'll get you into the big deals that don't even come to my desk. That was hot cognition one, intrigue. I wanted to meet the senior trader and get introduced to these bigger deals. The bank trader continued. You know, the market is on fire right now, and I have the French, the English, the South Africans begging me for this package. But if you work hard and you don't play any funny retrade games, you can earn your way in. It was true. The market was hot, and those were all players. That was hot cognition too, pricing. Although I was the buyer, he was asking me to prove myself. I wanted to impress him so that I could earn my way into the deal. He continued, I'd love to give you until next week, but this market is not letting me. And you have to make up your mind by Friday, he said. I'm totally okay with a no. There's no pressure, but Friday is D-Day. That was hot cognition number three, time frame. He gave me just enough time that I felt that I had free will. This wasn't time pressure, just a reasonable time constraint. In the end, the decision was mine to make. He continued, and I don't need to tell you, we've done $150 billion of trades just this year without a single SEC, that's the Securities Exchange Commission, sanction. Right now, we're very particular about our reputation and our counterparties. We do things right over here, so no games, no missing wire numbers, just clean paper. We give you a fair price, and that's the deal. Can you play by the rules? That was hot cognition number four, moral authority. I assured him that even though my company was small, just $250 million blip on the outskirts of San Diego, I knew the rules and that I could do things right. From the beginning, I never felt like he was selling me. My normal deal-making processes were disrupted by this four-frame stack. The Wall Street trader ran the stack on me perfectly. I was intrigued. I was trying to impress him so that I could have a chance to buy the deal. He boxed me into a very tight time frame, and yet I felt no time pressure. And I was trying hard to prove that I had good moral values. I was a puppet. My cold analytical decision processes weren't just disrupted. They were shut down and turned off. My neocortex was short-circuited. My croc brain was rolling around in cognitive mud, happy and calm. I was going to do the deal. And the next day, I called the Wall Street trader back and said, send me the docs. I'm in. There's no question that the pitch worked on me. Fortunately, it had also worked on Mike. Mike Hansen soon called me, bragging that he had taken down the deal, stolen it right out of my eager hands. Thank God for that. 2 years later, he was still down 15% in the trade and losing money daily. He was miserable with the deal, and for me, though, it had worked out fine, because I learned the four-frame hot cognition stack. Now, a few years later, I found this stack works in many kind of pitches. And it's a lot of fun for both me and the targets. It's hot, emotional, fast-paced. When the target starts getting analytical and cold, it's time for the four-frame hot cognition stack to enter the pitch. To make it work, you just implement the frames you already are familiar with from Chapter 2. All you have to do is learn how to stack them up one after the other to generate a hot cognition. In other words, to create what cognitive scientists call a wanting. Specifically, we're not trying to make the target like us, because learning to like something is slow and intellectual, and that's the business of the neocortex. That is not the business we're in. We want high-temperature frames that create hot cognitions, and we're using frame stacks to make sure the target's croc brain wants us and wants to move forward with us and even ends up chasing us to get the deal. Let's do it now. Here are the four frames we're going to stack in quick succession. Doing this correctly will move you quickly into the last part of the pitch, the hook point. So hot cognition number one is the intrigue frame. Hot cognition number two is the prize frame. Hot cognition number three is the time frame. Hot cognition number four is the moral authority frame. Let's get into hot cognition number one, the intrigue frame. In chapter two, we talked about the theory of frame-based pitching, and I introduced the intrigue frame. Now we're going to use it. The purpose is to get a large dopamine dump into the croc brain of the target and build desire. I do this by introducing something the target is sure to want, but he cannot get right now. Here's the intrigue frame I used recently in a situation where I'd given the pitch, offered up the deal, but before I could blink, was getting hammered with technical questions. Guys, before we spend our last few minutes on financial details, let's decide first if you love me and you love the basic deal. And look, if you decide you do love the deal, you're obviously going to want to meet my partner, Joshua. He's a very interesting guy, a great guy, but a little bit eccentric. I see if I have their attention, which I usually do. People like to hear stories about interesting and slightly eccentric characters. I tell them, last year, when the markets were volatile, I had this little deal at just about $10 million. It seemed easy because it was such a small deal and I was the only one working on it. Things were going like clockwork until the bank called at the 11th hour and backed out. No explanation. They just pulled out. That left a $3 million hole in my plan, and the deal was falling apart fast. This had come out of the blue, and I was sure that the board of directors of my company would fire me when they found out about this screw-up. I knew I had to go tell Joshua about this. My audience leans in. They want to find out how the problem was solved. And who is this Joshua? They are intrigued. Joshua asked me, "Hey, Oren, is this a good deal?" I said, "Yeah, it's a good deal. Let me tell you about it." But he didn't stick around to listen. Instead, he went to lunch without even giving me time to grovel. What could I do? I had to save the investors and myself too. I wanted to pitch Joshua to do anything to convince him to save the deal, give me $3 million, and help this thing get closed. He, it seemed, just wanted to eat lunch. I was preparing for my own funeral when I got a call from the board. They had mysteriously gotten $3 million. Joshua had wired it in from his BlackBerry while having sushi. He didn't ask me to sign any guarantees. He didn't even ask to see the file. If he hadn't made that wire, my investors would have lost a lot of money and my reputation would have taken a hit. The thing about it is that he does this kind of stuff all the time. Just wait until you meet him. This is the kind of narrative that targets truly enjoy. Who is this mystery man, Joshua? And how do we meet him? This works because it's not about what happened. That's actually a boring story. What's important is who it happened to and how the characters react to their situation. Nobody cares about narratives where you witnessed something. They want to see someone forced into action and positively overcoming obstacles. This new notion of building intrigue and an intrigue frame makes a lot of sense when you think about why the target is sitting there listening to your pitch. The targets have given you their time because they want to visit a new world to learn about new things and interesting ideas and become involved in the lives of unique, interesting, and talented people. No one is seriously going to go into business with you until they know something about how you conduct yourself in tough situations. And it's no use telling anyone, "I'm a good person." That's a useless analytical fact that has no narrative to support it. People want to know how you have faced obstacles and overcome them. They want to see you in situations that reveal your character. They want to know that you are someone who rises to whatever level necessary to overcome obstacles and someone who travels in the company of interesting people who are players in whatever game you are playing. This kind of story, according to Dr. Bruner, puts the target into narrative thinking mode. In narrative mode, we seek to understand reality from events in terms of human actors striving to do physical things over time. And from this simple statement, we draw an important insight. Your big idea is probably an abstract notion. If you're honest with yourself, what is it really? A pile of financials, a bunch of timelines, some customer orders, a marketing plan, an internet site, and some smart new ideas. You probably have projections, information technology, competitive analysis, and market timing. This kind of information is much too abstract. The target's brain does not love abstract concepts. Every abstract concept has to be kicked up to the neocortex to be worked on slowly and painstakingly. This is why you need analog human narratives to do your explaining. They don't have to be sent to the neocortex for processing. For example, the Joshua story, which I just told you, is anchored in the real world with human characters. The target can relate to the human elements in it. Why is the intrigue frame best performed as a narrative? Here's how the target's brain interprets narratives at a crocodile level. In narrative mode, the croc brain sees human characters confronting real-world obstacles in timescales that make sense. The croc brain can sort of verify events in time because they are easy to relate to our previous experiences and understanding of how the real world works. If the unfolding of events